You're listening to the Old Time Radio Show on 71K News Talk Radio. Now back to Denver's Old Time Radio History buff, John Dunning.
Okay, it's just about 3 minutes until four. This is KNUS in Denver. And I am very happy today to have Frank Nelson, who we just heard doing a caper, I guess, with Bob Bailey on the Markham matter, yours truly, Johnny Dollar. And according to Milt Josephsberg's book called The Jack Benny Show, we all know this anyway, but Frank Nelson had a frequent but indefinable role on the Benny program. He played a floor walker, of course, in the Christmas show, which they did every year. He played a waiter in restaurants, in supermarkets. He played a salesman. He played a ticket seller at the railroad station. But on all of these parts, he had one common denominator and one personality trait. No matter what the situation, he was always Jack Benny's arch enemy. And that one magic word that he uttered every week always sent the audience into hysterics. Frank Nelson, are you on the phone?
Yes.
Yes? You're still doing that for McDonald's.
You know, I just, no, I'm not just doing it for McDonald's now. I just finished doing it. I did it up until about the 10th of January. And the way I answered you just with the yes, you know, without stretching it or anything, I have to tell you a story about a director that came on the Benny Show at a particular point in time. And so we were sitting around the table reading, and Jack said, "Oh, Mr. Mister," and I said, "Yes." And we went on through the thing. And when we were through and going to do the rehearsal on mic, he walked up to me and he said, "Frank, don't do that." And I said, "What?" He said, "Don't do that." I said, "Don't do what?" He said, "Well, you know how you said the yes." He said, "Don't do that." I said, "Oh, all right." So get up there, and Jack said, "Oh, mister, mister." And I said, "Yes." Jack said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, the director told me not to do that." And Jack turned around, and he said, "Have you ever seen my show or heard my show?" And the director said, "Well, no, I haven't." He said, "Well, he's been doing that for 30 years. That's what I pay him to do."
It was probably the most famous one word in certainly that I can think of in all of the old-time radio I've heard.
Well, it lasted for 38 years, so I guess it had something.
38 years. Well, you must have started on it very early then.
Well, I started with Jack actually on June 1st, 1934. I wasn't doing the yes then. I was just doing parts with him. And, I'd say about 6 months into my association with him, 1 week I happened to stretch it. And the writers the next week said, "Hey, we're going to try that again." I said, "Try what?" He said, "Well, you remember you stretched out a yes and it got a laugh last week?" And I had to think about it. And I said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember." So I did. And so then we would, they one day decided they'd see what I could do with ooh. And so they haven't really cued Jack in. And Jack's line was, you really do hate me, don't you?" And I said, "Ooh, do I?" And he fell right on the floor. Right on the floor. But
this was in rehearsal, right?
Huh?
This was in rehearsal.
Oh, yeah.
He could also break up on the air, though.
Oh, yes. Oh, he broke up many times on the air. Many times on the air. You know, it's fun to talk to you in Denver. I don't think you know this, probably, but first broadcast I ever did was at KOA in Denver.
Really?
Yep. I started my career in 1926. I was still a kid in high school. And I did a show for the United States National Bank with a young lady by the name of Georgia Miller, and she was the wife and I was the husband in a series, and I went out to audition for it, and they looked at me and said, "What are you doing out here?" And I said, "Well, they told me you had something to be auditioned for," and they said, "Oh, well, this is a man of about 35 years of age." I said, "Oh, well, okay," and I started to leave, and the director said, "Well, look, have you ever read over a microphone?" I said, "No," and he said, "Well, maybe you'd like to stay in and read," and I said, "Well, yeah, sure." So I did, and there were 30 of us that auditioned that day, and the next day they called back 12, the next day they called back 4, and I got it. So I worked that, and then I worked at KFEL in Denver. I sold time and announced there. And I opened Denver University's little theater doing Marchbanks in Canada in either 28 or 29. So I have a Many good memories of Denver. My wife, my mother had a dress shop, as a matter of fact, at 412 East Colfax, opposite the cathedral there.
You really do know Denver, then?
Oh, yes, I do.
Well, I may have missed it. Maybe you already told me, but how did you happen to be in Denver in the first place?
Well, I went to Maury Junior High there, and I went to West High School there and graduated from West. Well, I lived there for a long time.
Well, did you mentioned KOA. Don Wilson was on KOA, wasn't he? Did you know him here then?
No, I didn't know Don. I think Don left there a little before I did, and I don't remember Don, and I don't think we met there at all. I met him at KFI out here when I came out here. But I know Don is from there. There was a Freeman Talbot was the director at that time and of KOA, and he informed me I couldn't possibly be an announcer because I didn't have a college degree, and he turned out to be wrong because I did announce many of the top shows out of Hollywood for a number of years.
You mean even back then you had to have a college degree?
Well, he thought that I did.
Today you don't even have to pass the FCC test anymore.
No.
Well, when you say you met Don Wilson at KFI? Was he already doing the Benny Show then?
No, he was not doing the Benny Show at that time. He was an announcer out here at that time. Yeah, I think he started with Jack's show out here. I don't believe he started in New York. I could be wrong on that. But I think he started out here with Jack. Jack's first show that I did with Jack out here, at that time everything was coming out of either Chicago or New York. And he was coming out here to do a movie, and they wanted to keep him alive in the show that he was doing back there, so they did a five-minute insert out here. And that's when the NBC studios were on the back end of the RKO lot. And John Swallow, who I had worked for at KFAC, KFED here, was the manager of NBC then. And so he called me to do this five-minute spot with Jack. And Jack's on the train coming out, and he meets this fella, and he's, telling him about what a great success he's going to be in Hollywood. And I'm very nice to him and noncommittal and polite and... Finally ends up and he says, I'm Jack Benny, and he said, I expect to star in pictures out there. You're a very personable young man, and I might be able to do something for you. What is your name? And my answer was Clark Gable. And that was the sketch. And then I did another five-minute sketch with him the following week. Then he went back to New York, and he was back there for several months. Then he came out here, and I started working his show after he came out here. And just doing casual characters at first, and then when we developed the character of the floor walker, I became his nemesis, is what he used to call me.
You never had a name?
No.
You were always...
I mean, if he was going to go to a psychiatrist, he'd call me Dr. Nelson, but I mean, there was never any name outside of my own. If they had to use a name, they'd use my own.
But even that, even the Dr. Nelson, wasn't that really kind of in the later years in the 1950s?
Yeah, in the early days, it had no name. It was just, aren't you the floor walker or a clerk or a waiter or whatever it was, you know. There was no reason for a name.
I think, to me at least, it was, oh my God, there's that guy again.
Yeah,
there's that guy.
Well, that was kind of the way it was received, and it was funny. I'd run into people, and they'd say, what do you do? I said, well, I work in radio. You ever hear the Jack Benny show? Oh, yeah, I hear it all the time. I said, well, you ever hear a fella, and Jack says, oh, mister, the fella says, yes. They say, oh, that's you. But they would not know me by sight or by name, because at that time they didn't publicize us very much.
Did you read Irving Fine's book?
Did I read what?
Irving Fine's book on Jack Benny?
No, I didn't read Irving's book. Irving is my pet hate.
Is he?
Yes, he is.
Well, you'll probably hate this anecdote in there. He says you got the most money for one word of anybody in radio or television until that time.
Well, that's a marvelous theory that he has. You see, Irving hated like the devil to turn loose of a buck. It just hurt him terribly. Jack didn't, but Irving did. And Jack didn't know what Irving did sometimes. For instance, I'll give you a story about Irving. One week, I got a call from the casting director, and he said, Frank, I'd like to have you on the show. This is in the television days. I'd like to have you on the show this week, but you're just voiceover. You're at the airport, and you're just coming over the PA, and so Irving thought that maybe you'd work for half of your regular salary. And I said, tell that, and I got just about that far, and he said, never mind, never mind. I'll call you back. So in about 20 minutes, he called back, and he said, okay. He said, see you tomorrow in your regular salary. And he said, now I'm going to tell you what happened. He said, Irving said, I'm not going to pay Nelson's salary to do this thing, so get another actor. So he said, I got another actor. The other actor went on stage, and as soon as Jack said something and this fellow started to talk, Jack said, where's Frank? And Irving says, well, I thought, he says, where's Frank? He said, get Frank. Irving says, yes, sir. So it ended up that he had to pay the other actor, and then he had to pay me my regular salary, so it cost me more than it would have to begin with.
Well, this anecdote he reports
in... is always that way.
Yeah, he indicates that in the book, because he was the Jack Benny's producer at the time, I believe.
Yes, he was... originally, he was his accountant, and then he ended up being his producer, finally. And of course, he's now George Burns' manager.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I think the anecdote is kind of revealing, because he talks in here about how he didn't want to pay your fee to come in and do this. Basically, what they needed was the yes. You know, he didn't want to pay the fee for that. And so he took it to Benny, at least as he has it in the book. And Benny says, of course we have to pay his fee. He's entitled to get his fee for the one word or whatever else he does. And they, according to Fine, they had a big conference with all the writers to decide whether the one word on this particular show was a big enough laugh to get the fee, and they went ahead and paid the fee because they decided it was.
Well, I'll give you 100-1 right now that isn't the way it happened, because if he wouldn't have dared go to Jack and ask that. He simply wouldn't do that. Jack would expect me to be there if the character was in.
And he certainly expect you to get paid for it.
That's right. And Jack would never have raised the issue about money in the first place. With the kind of money Jack was making, it didn't make any difference. You know, what he was going to pay me, when you figure what he was going to pay the government, it just didn't make that much difference. Matter of fact, I made a lot more money on other shows than I made on the Jack Benny show.
Hmm. The revealing thing, I think, about that anecdote, you know, even that he would tell it, it reveals that Jack Benny's character was the exact opposite of what he went to great lengths to promote on the air.
Jack was a very generous man, actually. He was a very charitable man. And, for instance, he would give $25,000, let's say, to Jewish War Relief during the war, with the stipulation that there be no publicity. There was another comedian out here that would give $5,000 with the stipulation there'd be a lot of publicity. That was the difference between the two.
Hmm.
But Jack was just that kind of a human being. He, when Mel was in that terrible auto accident, he was in a coma for 21 days. Jack sat at his bedside all that time.
This is Mel Blanc.
That's right. And he did the same with Eddie Anderson when Eddie had a stroke. He was out there at the hospital daily. He was a very, very decent and lovely man. He was not an easy man to know, to socialize with or anything like that. Now, Mel socialized with him a fair amount of time, but I never did socialize with Jack, but I certainly enjoyed working with him, and I admired him as a human being.
There are a number of stories about Jack Benny, about his need to, maybe he wasn't easy to know or socialize with, but apparently he was very easy to talk to, at least on a superficial level. I've heard that he would talk to anybody on the street.
I don't really know that one way or another. I mean, certainly he would chat with you in the studio, but you never felt that you were really close to Jack. I never felt I was, really close to him personally. But Jack, we'd chat about kind of inconsequential things. He saw me smoking a pipe one day, and the next week I came in and handed me a new pipe that he'd gone out and bought just because he saw me smoking it. So he was a very nice person, but when I say not easy to talk to, he was not easy to make conversation with, I guess is what I'm saying. At least not for me. But certainly he was another thing that that Jack would do. If there was an extra character on the show, for instance, they would get somebody, get a good actor, and the actor would be telling everybody, boy, I'm on the Jack Benny show this week. Be sure and catch it, because everybody was thrilled to work that show because it was number one for like 15, 18 years. So if that actor did not read exactly as Jack expected to hear it, not in any vicious way at all, but he would say to the director, no, get somebody else. Now, they would pay that actor, because he had to be paid. He'd been called. And Jack didn't object to that at all, but he just got somebody else. Now, very often, you see, Hilliard Marks, who was Murray's brother, was director part of the time, and there were other people until Freddie DeCordova came along. They just kind of sat in the seat and called themselves directors, but Jack fundamentally was the director. And they just wouldn't argue with Jack. They wouldn't say, well, wait a minute, let me have the actor do it a different way. And so it happened that at one time, when we were doing a radio show, I mean a television show that we had done in radio, I walked in, I said, oh, I'm doing the lawyer. And the writer said, shh, don't say that. I said, what do you mean? They said, you're not doing the writer. We don't want Jack to know this is an old radio show. And I said, oh, come on, you think Jack won't recognize this show, won't know what it is? And no, he won't. And I said, well, okay, fine. Well, the lawyer was a what you call a non sequitur. You would say one thing, the lawyer would say something entirely unrelated to that. It might sound a little like that, but it was unrelated to what you said. So it was the kind of a part you had to learn completely by rote. You had nothing to hang on to. So they replaced the actor about four times. And finally, I got a call from Freddie DeCordova about two nights before showtime, and he said, Frank, Jack wants you to do the part of the lawyer. And I said, well, I'm not going to do the part of the lawyer. He said, I don't think you heard me. I said, Jack wants you to do the part of the lawyer. I said, I don't care what Jack wants me to do. At this late time, I have no intention of learning that part. And you have now gone through about four actors, all of whom are quite capable, and if somebody will tell this particular actor what they want, he is quite capable of doing it, and he will do it. He said, well, I'll call you back. So about an hour passed, and he called back, and he said, Frank, we're going to go with the actor that we have, but he said, I didn't give Jack your message. I said, well, that's very kind of you, and I know why you didn't, and it was probably not a smart thing for me to say, but I just felt that way about it. Well, they did go with the actor, and it turned out that he did a superb job. And when it was over, Jack went over and put his arms around him, told him how great he was, and then used him in about six successive shows after that. Now, the man would never have worked again if I hadn't just said, no, I'm not going to do it. So it was that kind of thing that was difficult for other actors when they came on the show. It was, unless they really came up with exactly what he expected to hear, then they never worked the show again.
Well, it sounds like, you know, Jack Benny has a, I think this is accurate, has a reputation as being not a particularly good comedy writer. It sounds like he was performing the function of a writer, at least in that kind of situation.
Actually, Jack had a great deal to do with the writing. The writers would maybe fight over a line for a long time, and nine times out of ten it would be Jack who said what was in and what was out. So he did have an extremely good comedy sense. And of course, if you stop and think about Jack, he was so different than any other comedian that you could name, because Jack did not do jokes. There were no jokes in Jack's dialogue. If you read Jack's dialogue, you'd say, what's funny about this? Well, what was funny was it had to do with his character of being cheap, or it was like, you know, when Mel said, your money or your life, and he said, I'm thinking. Well, that went to the cheapness of his character, and it was a huge laugh. But Jack's dialogue as such was not funny. Never was. He gave all the jokes to his second bananas. He had them. And it takes a great deal of confidence in yourself to be able to do that. There are very few comics that have that much confidence in their way of putting a show together that they will turn all the jokes over to other people. And Jack did that, if you think about it.
Yeah, you know, one of the funniest things that he did, I think, it's recounted a little bit in Milt Josephsberg's book. Speaking of Josephsberg, I wanted to ask you, how did you get along with the writers?
Oh, fine. They all like to do me. They all hoped that something had happened to me, so they could all. Every time I walked in, they were all doing the yes, and I got along very well with them.
Well, in Josephsberg, he talks about one of the things I loved about the Benny Show was how if they blew a line, they would play on it and build on it throughout the. I was wondering if some of that wasn't. If some of those lines maybe weren't blown in dress rehearsal and built into the show, or.
Oh. No.
They were actually blown on the air.
That's right. For instance, Mary had one where she came in, and I was the soda jerk, and she said, I'll have a Chisweeze sandwich. And that played for weeks. And that happened on the show. It did not happen in rehearsal.
Those running gags were just fantastic.
That's right. Another one was when Harris had Manischewitz bits. You know, I mean, he just garbled it, and they did Manischewitz bits for a long time. I'll tell you the most famous one, probably. I don't know whether it's in his book or not, but it probably is. Don Wilson had a line early in the show. Oh, first, I have to back up to myself. I had a line, and Jack says, oh, Mr. Mister, I say, yes. He said, are you the doorman? I said, well, who do you think I am in this uniform, Nelson Eddy?
That's the one. I'll just let you tell that. I was going to read it, but I'll let you tell it.
Okay, so he said, Nelson Eddy, and he said, you know, I don't like that joke for Frank. We got to get a different joke. He said, I don't like the Nelson Eddy joke. Well, we get the show, and they haven't changed the joke. Now, early in the show, Don Wilson had a line about Drew Pearson, the famous columnist, and it came out Greer Pearson. Well, that got a tremendous laugh out of the audience and broke Jack up. Now I look up at the booth, and the writers are motioning to me to come into the booth. So I get up and go back and walk in the booth. I said, what do you want? They said, look, when you get to the line, says, are you the doorman? Say, well, who do you think I am in this uniform, Greer Pearson? I said, come on, fellas, it doesn't even track. They said, never mind whether it tracks, do it. I said, now look, nobody ad-libs with Jack, and you know that. They said, we will take the responsibility for having given you the line. I think if it had died out there, they'd have all said, he did it on his own. I don't know. But anyway, I went back out, and now we get to the thing, and Jack said, oh, Mr., Mr., and I always had my back to him, and I whirled into the mic, and I said, he is. And he said, excuse me, are you the doorman? And as he said it, I saw this dull look come into his eyes like, oh, good Lord, here comes that line I don't want to hear. And I stared right into his eyes, and I said, well, who do you think I am in this uniform, Greer Pearson? Well, his eyes got like two saucers. He began to laugh. He grabbed a hold of the microphone. He slid down the microphone to the floor, pounded on the floor, got up, staggered clear across the stage to the far wall, turned around into the curtains, got a hold of the curtains, slid down the curtains, pounded on the floor some more, got up and staggered back to the mic, and the laugh is going on through this whole thing.
This is all live.
That's just all live. And it went on through the whole thing. Now he gets back to the microphone. I thought he'd never, you know, get back to the script. And I really think that this is probably the longest laugh we ever had on the Benny Show.
Longer than your money or your life?
Yeah, I think it was longer than that. I think it was, but it wasn't planned, you see. It just happened. And so then for weeks after that, I would run into writers from other shows, and they'd say, that whole thing was a planned routine, wasn't it? I said, no, it was not. And I'd tell them this story very much as I've told you, and they all thought I was lying to them. There wasn't a one of them was convinced that I was telling them the truth, and it's absolutely the way it happened.
There was a wonderful one that Mary blew. In fact, I even said on the air, you know, I really think that must have been done in rehearsal, and apparently I'm wrong, but there was a wonderful line that she blew where she was supposed to say, he says, where's my car? And she says, it's up on the grease rack. And she says, it's up there on the grass reek. And they used that for about 3 or 4 weeks running. I think there was a line in there about a couple of skunks getting out, and they're over there, boy, that grass reeks or something like that. The writers were ingenious.
Once anything like that happened, they would pick it up. No, Mary, you couldn't write that kind of a breakup for Mary, because she wouldn't be able to do it. She just wouldn't be able to handle that kind of a thing and make it sound like anything but a phony thing. No, there was never a single one of those things that was written into the script.
when you came on for a show, you pretty much had to work, what, 4 or 5 days on it, right?
Oh, no. But now, are you talking radio now?
I'm talking rehearsals and everything.
Well, radio, we would come in on a Thursday, read through once. Then we'd come back on Saturday. I'm talking now TV. We'd read on Thursday, then we would rehearse. Yeah, if you had a TV show, you might run 4 days. But if you had a radio show, you'd come in on Saturday, read through the script, and come back on Sunday, read through sitting down, get up and read once around the mic, and that was it. Then you'd do the show. That's all we ever did.
Mm-hmm.
There was no long rehearsal in the radio days at all. In the first place, everybody, practically everybody on the show you see knew each other and worked with each other all the time, and it was just a case of if they thought they had to do some work on the script, they'd do that, but outside of that, it was just a read-through and go.
And it was all built on personalities that had been established years before.
Well, sure. You take, you heard the fellow come in and say, "Hello, stranger." Well, that was Sam Hearn. Sam would be on occasionally, but everybody knew the character. Artie Arbach, Pickle in the Middle with the mustard on top. Andy Devine, "Hiya, Buck." Sheldon Leonard and Benny Rubin, each doing the tout. Benny Rubin did it first, and then when Benny was out of town once, Sheldon Leonard came on, did it, and he liked Sheldon better, and so Sheldon did it. But those were the people that were around him all the time, with Mary, of course, and Phil Harris, and the singer, Dennis Day, or whoever the singer was at the moment, you know, those that was his whole cast.
You also did it on TV.
Yep. I didn't, you see, none of us, the regulars, worked near as much in TV as we did in radio. In radio, I was under contract to him, and we'd do 39 shows in the season, and I'd usually do anywhere from 26 to 30 out of the 39. Then when we went to television, you'd do about 22 shows in the season, and I would maybe do 6 or 7. That was about all.
How did you personally cope or take to the transition to television?
Well, it didn't bother me. I had come out of theater originally. That's where I started. And so from theater, I went into radio. And so really, I was going back into theater to a certain extent. It did disturb some people. There were some people that didn't make the transition well at all and really kind of dropped out after the radio days. Of course, there was one tremendous thing about radio versus television, and that is you could do anything that you could do vocally. So I could be a leading man, I could be an old man, a young man, a Frenchman, a Scotsman, a heavy. I could do all those things in radio. But once you got on television and you had the kind of a character I did with Jack, you were not going to do anything else. You were going to do an offshoot of that character. Because everybody was going to call you for that. Nobody's going to call you to do a heavy in a picture or in a television show. You know, they're just not.
Right.
So you were put into a much more narrow confine than you were in radio. Radio I enjoy far more than I do television.
Listen, I've got to take a break. Can you hang on and talk for a little bit longer?
Sure.
You're listening to the Old Time Radio Show on 71K News, the station that brings the world to you. Now back to Denver's Old Time Radio history buff, John Dunning.
And the Old Time Radio Show is brought to you by the Public Service Company, as you just heard. And we've had a couple of calls. Let it ring through when you call, because we get a little busy here sometime. We're talking to Frank Nelson from, all I got is an area code. Are you in Los Angeles?
Mm-hmm.
You mean yes?
Yeah.
Let's go to the phone in a minute, she says.
John?
Yes.
I noticed when I was waiting to go on with you that you were playing a Johnny Dollar.
Yes.
Yeah, I worked that show from off and on from 58 through 60, 57, 58, 59, and 60, and that's next to the last radio show that I did. I did a Johnny Dollar on March 20th of 1960, and the very last show I did was an Amos and Andy on May 17th, 1960, of radio.
Amos and Andy, wow, that would have been really near the end of that, too.
Yep.
It was called Amos and Andy Music Hall then, wasn't it?
Uh-huh. That's right.
I'm trying to find my notes here and see what the date on that was. I believe I gave it a minute ago, but I don't seem to have it here. Oh, yeah, there it is. November 18th, 1956 was what that was. And you had a major role in that, actually, continuing all the way through the... But that voice was just so unmistakable. It was unusual, because usually the broker was just there for the beginning of that show.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, we bounced from show to show. Of course, I did Blondie. I did my first Blondie in 1939 and did the last one on January 12th of 1950. And in that, I played Herb Woodley, the next-door neighbor.
Right.
And so we bounced from show to show. I was one of the two announcers. I was the billboard announcer on Lux Radio Theater for 2.5 years.
When was that?
Well, at the beginning of Lux Out Here. I'd have to look at my books to tell you the exact date of it, but when it first came out here, I did the billboard announcing and then doubled into the show. And just looking to see if I could pick up a date on it here, but I don't know if I can.
I wanted to ask you while you're looking about Phil Harris, whose shows survive in such wonderful sound and are so obviously influenced by Jack Benny.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, he had the Frankie, the banjo player, you know, was supposed to be his sidekick in that.
Right.
And it was patterned to a great extent after what he had learned, really, with Jack. But
let me ask you in a minute about that show specifically. But let's take a couple of calls.
Okay.
Okay. This is John Dunning. You're on 71 K News Talk Radio.
Okay, John. This is Bill.
How are you?
Not too bad. And I got a question for Frank concerning the TV version of the Jack Benny Show. It was a show in which Jack drove you so crazy that you literally went up the wall. And I was wondering, was there any particular visual effect that they did, or just how did you handle that?
I think that's where I was the psychiatrist, wasn't I?
I don't remember right off
the
bat.
Yeah, I think I was a psychiatrist. No, I just climbed up the side of the wall. They had some things that I could get my hands on, and I did that.
I remember the lady said, "He's pointing right at the wall. I just don't understand it."
This is a show you remember from when it was on?
This was from the rerun that they had about 5 or 6 years ago.
Oh, yes. That was on PBS, wasn't it?
No. As a matter of fact, it was on Channel 4.
On NBC?
Yes. I think they got it on a syndicated basis because it was preceded by Burns and Allen, which, by the way, is running here in Denver as reruns on Channel 12, in case some are interested. There may be something most of them already know. Well, anyway, but I was kind of wondering about that. And also, just real quick here, I'm trying to find a blank reel that I can dub off a particular show, and I just... ironically, quite unintentionally, ran across the very show you were talking about where Mary blew the thing about the grease rack.
Ah.
I think it was last winter sometime, and it was the thing of how they got a hold of Rochester, which featured guests Amos and Andy.
Oh, yeah. Freeman Gosden and Charles Carell were on the show, right.
And the thing was that somehow, I think it was Jack hit Rochester, and he was up on the grease rack, and Mary asked him, how in the world could you hit Rochester when he was up on the grass rake?
The grass rake. Okay, anything else?
No, I can't think of anything right now.
Okay, well, thanks for calling. Okay, we just lost that one.
I can tell you a little story about Rochester and how he got on the Benny Show.
Okay.
The only time that I ever turned Jack down in my life, I would get out of other shows. This is before I was contracted to him, and I'd get out of other shows in order to do his show. Well, he called me one week quite late, and I already had 4 commitments for Sunday, and I said, there's just no way I can do it. I'm sorry. What he wanted me to do was a porter on a train coming from Albuquerque. And it's a very fortunate thing that I was busy and they couldn't get me because they went out and they got a young man by the name of Eddie Anderson. And Jack was so impressed by him that he said, hey, we got to find a spot for him on the show. And he became his valet on the show. That's the way he got on the show.
Maybe you almost had the role of the Rochester guy.
Well, it never would have developed that way.
No,
it just have been a one-shot if I had done it. But because he had this very distinctive voice and all, Jack was so intrigued with him, he said, hey, we got to do something else besides this porter bit.
Right, right. But what I mean is you almost got the role that in other words, if you had done that show, maybe there wouldn't have been any Rochester.
That's right. That is correct.
I think that was around Easter 1937, wasn't it?
I couldn't give you the date. I really don't remember.
It went back a ways, though.
Yeah, long ways.
The Phil Harris Alice Faye Show was written by Ray Singer and Dick Chevalier.
Yeah.
And when we talk about the kind of comedy that they did as being so similar to what was on the Jack Benny Show, actually much of that was written by two writers who, as far as I know, never served any time on the Benny Show, right?
Well, neither one of those ever wrote for Jack, but they certainly knew the formula.
I wonder if Harris himself had a hand in setting the direction of that program.
I honestly don't know. I worked Phil's show a number of times, but I didn't get any real feeling of him working with the writers very closely on, you know, putting a script together. But he might well have done that, and I might not have known about it, because I just, you know, I was there as an actor, and that's all. But it was a fun show to do.
Elliot Lewis was another one who was on Benny's show a lot, wasn't he?
Well, Elliot used to come on, and he did what they called the moolie. We called him a moolie. He'd be goofy guy, you know. And we did one routine between Elliot and myself that turned out to be just an absolute screamingly funny routine. And we were scared to death of it, because if it died early, you were dead, because you had to go on with it. You couldn't get off of it. And what it was, he gets up to the line ahead of Jack to get a ticket. And he says, "I'd like a ticket for Glockamora." And I say, "Yes, sir." He said, "Is that little brook still, you know, how are things in Glockamora?" I said, "Fine, fine, just fine." He says, "Is that little brook still running there?" I said, "Yes, yes, it is." And we did every line of the song that way. And it just kept building, and of course, Jack doing the looks behind him. And it went from the beginning of the song to the end with every one of the lyrics, and it played, just kept building and building and building. Then they tried it. It was so successful, they tried it again with another song about a year later, and it died a morning. And we still had to do it, because there was no way out of it, you see.
Was that the Tennessee Waltz?
I'm not sure. I don't remember what it was. I don't think I really want to remember what it was, because it just died, that's all.
Josephsburg, in his book, recounts that you and I believe it was Elliot Lewis, did the Tennessee Waltz that way.
Well, then probably we did. That's probably the second one. Only the one that really played was How Are Things in Glockamora.
Yeah, I think that's in Irving Fine's book.
Yeah.
That's wonderful comedy when you can build something like that into.
Oh, it was just tremendous, and yet you can see what a chancy kind of a routine it was, because if it didn't start to play right from the beginning, you were going nowhere except downhill for a long time.
Right. Fred Allen used to do some great things with music. Did you ever work with him?
Yes, I worked with Allen when he was working with Jack on about, I think, two or three shows. Where Allen was on, when they had the feud going, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's your opinion of Fred Allen?
Oh, I think he was born like 20 years too soon. The kind of comedy that he did that was so magnificent, and he was the comedian's comedian. Every comedian adored him, thought he was the greatest thing that ever came down the pike. But he was too sharp for the people, generally speaking. And then comedy began to change, and I think he would have done very, very well on today's market, or back a piece from now, even. But I just think he was a little before his time. You see, he never had a high rating, and yet every comedian loved him.
Yeah, I know he took a greater role in the actual writing of the show.
Oh, yes.
He actually
pretty
did,
much.
Yeah.
Much.
There were some fairly high-powered writers that worked for him. Herman Walk.
Yep.
Was one of them,
yep.
Back in the 30s.
But I think Fred had more to say about what was in the final script than most comedians do.
When Jack Benny when his program was written, it was usually, didn't they get together right after the show on Sunday and sit down and go over ideas for next week?
Now you're asking me something I don't know. They might have had a writer's meeting afterwards. I really don't know. It's quite possibly did, especially if something happened on the show that they were going to hang things on the next week, you know, like one of the breakups or something, then they might well have done that. I didn't realize that they did it on any regular basis, however.
Mm.
I wouldn't say they did or didn't, because I really don't know.
I got another listener who wants to talk to you.
Uh-huh.
Hi, this is John Dunning. You're on 71K News Talk Radio.
Yeah, John, this is Jim. How are you?
Pretty good.
I'd like to ask Mr. Nelson, did you do any of the Lum and Abner shows?
Yes, I did a few of the Lum and Abner shows. Not a lot of them, but a few of them.
Yes, of course. I think Lum and Abner, I believe, first started out, what, on WLW in Cincinnati. And after it went to the network, I don't know, they cleaned up their English, and I just didn't think their show was nearly as good as it was to begin with.
What kind of character did you play on Lum and Abner, do you remember?
Oh, golly, that's going back too far to give you any idea of what I did. It would just be a casual character, because most of the script between them was between the two of them, as you know. And they were just incidental characters. What you'd call an incidental character would come in now and then, and I did a few of those with them, but nothing of any import.
Okay, Jim, is that it?
Well, no, I would agree with him that that Fred Allen was ahead of his time, and maybe I missed it, but I just wonder how Mr. Nelson feels that Allen might, if he would have made the transition from radio to television.
I think he could have. You know, he was acerbic and funny. I think it would have been maybe even an easier transition for him to go into the television end of it than it was for Jack. Because if you think about Jack, so many of his major motion pictures were bombs. And when you think about television, all it is small screen movies. And consequently, I'm inclined to think that Fred might have made an easier transition than Jack did, even. See, I think Jack was absolutely at his best in radio. I think that's when he was absolutely superb.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. Well, I sure thank you for your time, Mr. Nelson. I would like to say that I've enjoyed everything that I've heard you on, and believe me, that's been quite a bit. Thank you, John.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for calling. Hello, you're on 71K News Talk Radio.
Hi.
Yes.
I was, a question I want to ask is that it seemed to me that in regard to Fred Allen that you were talking about the writing of a script, and it seemed to me that lots of times there were pretty lousy jokes in there, and I wondered if they were purposely written as kind of crummy jokes, and he played off of them. It seemed to, you know, he always ran out of time. The show was cut off at the end almost all, very consistently. And I just wondered if he ad-libbed, you know, if the material was arranged for him to ad-lib, because that was the funny part of the show, I thought, was his quick wit.
Frank, do you have any opinion on that?
Don, you're going to have to relay the question. I can't hear a single word the gentleman's saying.
What he said was that on many of the Fred Allen shows, his feeling is that the jokes that were imparted were so bad that was what became funny, and he wondered if that was done intentionally for Allen to ad lib off of.
Well, that's a hard question to answer. You see, I don't think of the jokes as being that bad. I just think that they were many of them ahead of their time. They were just too soon. They weren't prepared for the kind of jokes he did. But I guess I'm not familiar enough with the area that he's talking about in relation to those shows.
Let me see if I can take a quick shot at that. What he's talking about, I think, is that if it's true that Fred Allen came along too soon, we now have the benefit of 30 years to look back at them, and I think what he's saying is that some of Allen's comedy may not stand up as well, but I think that what we get into is that he was dealing with material that was topical at the time, and it was meant to be a cornball interpretation of what was going on in the world at that time.
That's right, and my feeling is that he would be much more acerbic today in handling that. He'd be more in the quality of a Mort Saul in the way he handled topical material, except I think he'd be funnier, personally.
Yeah, I want to say, John, I presume you can't hear me, but that Fred Allen was my favorite of all the radio shows, comedians, and you know, I didn't mean it as a put down. I just thought that that's the impression I got, that some of the jokes were rather feeble, and then he worked off of that.
Okay, well, thanks much for calling.
Bye.
Hello, you're on 71K News Talk Radio.
Well, you finally got through to me.
There's somebody trying to imitate you.
Yeah.
This is Fred, John.
Huh?
This is Fred.
Well, I don't think you quite made it, but give us a try anyway.
Okay. Made what?
Was that a Frank Nelson try?
Yeah. I was just wondering if Mr. Nelson could possibly tell me why seeing that George Burns and Jack Benny were such good friends, I can never recall George Burns ever being on his program.
John?
No, I can't either. Jack Benny was on George Burns' show a lot. I tell you the truth, you know, I've heard so many of these things, I'd have to consult my indexer at home. I have an index of these shows, but off the top of my alleged head, I can't recall Burns ever going on Benny's show either.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, he was on.
I'm sure he was, but I just don't remember.
No, I can't either, but if he was, then that's good. And just if you can't hear me, relay to him that I've enjoyed him for many years, and I also enjoy him for many more years.
Well, thanks much for calling.
Okay.
You say you finished with the McDonald's stuff now, huh?
Yes, we finished those on the 10th of January.
What are you doing now?
Well, sitting, doing interviews.
Doing commercials?
Huh?
Doing any other commercials?
Not at the moment. I think after that campaign, which was an extremely heavy campaign, it'll be a while before somebody wants me. Did I tell you, incidentally, that I didn't expect to even be talking to you today?
No.
Oh, well, I was supposed to do an interview yesterday between 11 and 12 with a gentleman in South Carolina. And I sat here until noon, and I thought, well, that's funny he hasn't called. I picked up the phone. It was stone dead. Mm. And it was dead until just about an hour before you called me.
You know, I had a nightmare that I was not going to be able to get through to you today because we got...
I didn't think you would. up until an hour before you called, the phone was stone dead.
We got some good press on your being on, and usually when you get something like that, it doesn't work out for one reason or another.
Yeah, well, I called the phone company and hollered at them and said, you know, I've already wrecked one show, and now I'm going to wreck another show, and I wish you'd see what you can do about this, and they finally got it just about an hour before you called.
Listen, when you do a campaign like McDonald's, and the tie-in to the Jack Benny show, which has been gone now for, the radio show has been gone now for 25 years, your tie to that is so subtle. A whole generation of viewers are going to look at those spots and probably not know what they're doing. How does McDonald's come up with something like that, or what?
Well, as I understand it, the head of Needham, Harper, and Steers, you want the boring story of how I got the commercial?
Sure.
All right. I got a call one day from AFRA out here. AFRA called me and said that they wanted me to call Chicago, Needham, Harper, and Steers, and talk to a lady by the name of Virginia Dalton about some McDonald's commercials. So I called her. And I said, I don't understand why you don't have my phone number. I don't even have an agent anymore. And I said, I don't understand why you don't have my phone number, because I've done four commercials for you. And she said, well, we're a big agency. There are four floors here, and one floor doesn't necessarily know what the other's doing. But would you be interested? And I said, yeah, sure. So about 20 minutes passed, and she called back, and she said, Frank, I checked on those commercials. Those were voiceover. And I said, yes. She said, well, this is on camera. And then this is the way an actor sells himself. I said, what in the hell do you want with me on camera? And there was a pause, and she said, well, we thought we might. And I said, well, if you do, okay, but I can't figure out what you want with me on camera. So then on the following Monday, I was called to go out into Burbank and do an audition at a small studio out there. And I went out there, walk in, and a young man, 26 years old, walks out of the back room, and he said, I'm Bill Brichta of Needham, Harper, and Steers, and I wrote the commercials. And I said, oh, I know. You're going to tell me that your mother used to carry you into the theater in her arms and you watched me perform. And he said, no, no. He said, I know the character, and our boss is a great fan of the Benny Show. So that's supposedly where it came from. So I then did the commercials, and when we got all through, he said, no, I can't go back to Chicago without autographs. And I thought, oh, come on, you're putting me on. And so he brought these five scripts in that I had done, and I said, first one he said is to so-and-so. I said, now who is that? He said, that's the head of Needham, Harper, and Steers. I said, by all means. So I autographed each of these, the people he asked me to autograph them to, and left and came home and said to my wife, there isn't a snowball of a chance in hell of my getting that job, because any time you get all that kind of treatment, nothing happens. 3 days later, they called and said they wanted me to do it. Hmm. And the funny thing is, that's the first time McDonald's has ever done anything except real people, you know, just folks doing commercials. And actually, it's the biggest single campaign they have ever done. They called me 2 weeks into the campaign and said that McDonald's was so happy with it, they were putting an additional $500,000 into network advertising. So it evidently was a very successful campaign for them, and I'm happy to have worked for them, and I got a kick out of doing it. And you're talking about the character. There's a very strange thing happened. You see, I wondered. I thought, Now, what are the kids going to think about this today? It's a long time since my son used to come home from school and say, you know, Dad, I am sick of you, because all the kids in school were doing the yes. Okay, all the kids back doing it again. All the kids, they go into McDonald's and they say, I'll have a hamburger, and they say, Big Mac, yes, and they're all doing this bit. And I have had kids run up and rap on my window, and I roll the window down, and they do the yes at me and then run. And it's strange, but the young people have picked up on it just exactly as they did back in the Benny days.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it is.
Your wife, Viola Vaughn,
yep,
was also on the Jack Benny show for...
And she used to do a lot of femme fatales. You know, if there was a sexy French gal or a sexy... Italian girl, or whatever it happened to be. She did a lot of those. She worked with Bob Hope a great deal. She did Mademoiselle Fifi with Eddie Cantor. And, of course, she hasn't been working at it. I'll tell you what we do now. We have a thing that we do called the Golden Days of Radio. And so she and I do the Bickersons now.
Really?
Yeah. We have a lot of fun doing that.
I heard Don Ameche doing that not all that long ago.
Don did it, of course, for years.
He was doing it in a commercial, I think.
Oh, did he?
This has been, not that long ago, I say 5 years ago.
Uh-huh.
So I guess...
wrote that, who was the same fellow that wrote the Fanny Price show.
I'm sorry, I think I drowned you out. What was the name?
Phil Rapp, I say, wrote the Bickersons, and he's the same one that wrote the Fanny Price show, the Baby Snook show.
Did you guys read the Josephsburg book?
Did I?
Yeah.
No. He keeps trying to get me to buy it. I say, give it to me, and he won't.
There are some funny things about your wife's role in the Jack Benny show in there she might enjoy. I don't know whether she would enjoy them or not, but Josephsburg goes into... In fact, I'd love to talk to her sometime. I'd love to talk to both of you again.
Good.
There's an anecdote in here. I don't know if you remember the famous fraternity pin show.
Fraternity.
Well, I think I'd get her on sometime and ask her about that. Josephsburg goes into into great description of what she looked like.
I see.
And he's
talking about.
Huh?
I know what he's talking about.
Well, he says that if she and Raquel Welch were standing in the same spot, you'd walk past Raquel and say, sorry, move out of the way, I want to talk to the girl. And there was a kind of an offbeat joke about fraternity pins. She was only supposed to be wearing 13 fraternity pins, and the censor burst in on them. And this 13 grew to 350 before the censor was through, and it actually became a dirtier joke than if it were only 13. Something
well,
like that.
I'll tell you, I think Milt's enlarging on things a little bit, but...
anyway, would she be available to talk to us sometime?
Oh, sure.
I would love to do that.
Of course.
How often was she on the Benny program?
Well, she used to... Sometimes she would stand by if Mary wasn't feeling too well. Mary used to faint a lot.
Really?
Yeah, she'd have spells when she would faint, and sometimes, boy, she'd hit that stage, and that was it. And usually it would be after the show, right at the conclusion of the show. I don't remember Mary ever fainting during a show, but I sure remember her fainting a great many times after a show.
Did she have mic fright?
I don't know. I don't know whether it was that or just a general nervousness or what the devil it was. I really don't know. But if she was not feeling too well, they would often have Viola down there just to stand by, just in case something happened to her, just to pick up and do her lines. But there are other times they would have her in there doing, as I say, the femme fatale type of thing.
Did she substitute for Mary later after she left the show?
No. She never substituted for Mary as such. Uh-huh.
Now, Mary Livingston actually left the program because of the fact that the pressures...
She wouldn't do the television shows. She just wouldn't do them.
She left the radio...
They trapped her into doing one, but I mean, she just wouldn't do them.
I believe she left the radio show, too.
Well, she may have towards the end. I really don't remember that. Now, Viola might know more about that than I do. She might have stood in for her on an occasion. I really don't know. I've said she hadn't, but I could be wrong on that.
You know, we played one the other night from 1954, and the actress who was playing the part was good, but there was such a difference. She didn't have that bite.
And now, Mary was Mary, you know. I mean, and when you've done a thing that long, you don't try to step into somebody else's shoes unless it's just a necessity. You just have to do it, that's all. Because you're never going to be compared favorably.
That's right. We have one more caller here. Hello, this is John Dunning here on 71 K News Talk Radio.
I'd like to ask, what was the most funny or embarrassing thing that ever happened to you in radio?
Good question. Did you get that?
What was the...
The funniest and the most embarrassing.
Well, I really think that the Dreer Poussin story that I told you earlier was probably the funniest. I got more of a kick out than anything out of the reaction of Jack, you know. I mean, it was such a... It just broke him up so completely that I would say that's about as funny as anything happened to me. Embarrassing, I don't know. It's embarrassing when you make a mistake. It's embarrassing when you do something on a dramatic show like I did once when I had a very dramatic scene which the first act ended with, you've killed my boy. And, no, you killed my son was the line.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to say boy and tried to change back and it came out, you killed my soy. Now, you know, that leaves you in a fine state of affairs, and now I have to go back and do the second act, and I'm thinking, oh my God, a highly dramatic show, and I did a thing like that, and then the director, having no heart at all, handed me a little note just as I'm going to open the second act, and I flip it open, and it says, my little soy, how have you been? And then I practically couldn't go on. I practically couldn't get the words out.
You hear a lot about things that happen on the air, in line with this caller's question, where there are a lot of games played on the air. I don't know if this happened on shows like The Benny Show, where somebody would, you would be on mic and somebody would come and jerk your pants down or set.
Oh, we used to do that to each other all the time in the early days before, not on network shows, but when I was working locally here, we used to do that all the time.
Well, what is your model?
Walk
your
into the booth naked. You know, and throw you a cue. You're supposed to do the news now.
They would throw you a cue
right.
From the booth?
Yep.
Yeah, I was going to ask your most memorable experience in Denver radio since you said you worked here.
Well, I guess I did. As I say, the first thing that I did was this show for a bank back there in which I played the husband. I was about 15, I think, and the young lady was a beautiful redhead of 32. If I had known then what I know now, I could have enjoyed the part more, I'm sure. But I remember one thing that happened to me on that. I think probably in all of my career in radio, I missed exactly one broadcast. And that didn't happen to be in Denver, but I was taken by ambulance and carried in on a stretcher while I was doing that series, and from the stretcher played the husband one night.
Wow.
And the one time that I actually missed a show was when I went back with Jack to New York, and I got out of bed. I had a fever of 104. I got out of bed, went down in a snowstorm, and did the first show. And when he found out that I was that ill and that the doctor had allowed me to get out of bed, he was ready to kill somebody. And, of course, he would not allow me to come back and do the second show, and so the writers fought for the privilege of doing my part on the second show. And that's the only show that I ever missed in my whole career in radio.
Frank, we are coming up on the hour. I really have enjoyed having you on. I would love to have you back. I hate to monopolize your life, but I've only touched on one show today, and I would like to talk about some of the other things you've done. And I would also like to have your wife on, if that could be arranged.
Well, sure, why not?
Okay, well, thanks much for being with us.
You betcha, John. And you let us know.
I sure will. We'll talk to you again.
Right.
Okay, that was Frank Nelson, wonderful actor from The Jack Benny Show and other programs, talking to us from Los Angeles, and we are going to talk to him again because he was on many shows.